Today, I would like to welcome one of the great pianists of the 20th century to Crossover, certainly one of the bravest as well, Byron Janis. Welcome here to WRTI.
Thank you.
I am without a doubt inspired by your story and transported by your playing, have always been.
You really are
a phenomenal artist, and your story is really quite phenomenal as well. And we're going to share that with our audience today. Let's talk a little bit about how you started. You know, you were a child prodigy.
Yes, I started playing when I was four, mm-hmm. by ear, of course, in kindergarten. I had a xylophone given to me as a present, and I took it to school, and I would play what the teacher was playing on the piano, and she said, "Can you do that on the piano?" I said, "I don't know," and she lifted me up on the seat, and I, of course, did the same, played exactly what she was playing. So that's how I started playing the piano.
And you have perfect pitch as well, right?
Yes, I do. Sometimes, by the way, it is...
That can be a curse.
It can be, yes. It's not always an advantage.
Yeah.
But it can be. If you're a little lost or something, and you can hear the note that you should be playing, and you go to it. But
when the orchestra's out of tune, it's very...
Yes, that is not too good. At any rate... Yes, I started. I worked with a local teacher there of Russian descent who had been to the Leningrad, who studied in Russia in the Leningrad Conservatory. Mm-hmm. But he was a rather, he was an eccentric and difficult man for a young boy, because he had a ruler which he would take out when I played a wrong note, and bang, the ruler would go on to my back of my hand.
Terrible.
And it hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would try not to cry and all this. And so my mother was very upset by this, and he said, "Mrs. Yanks, do you want..." My name was... Actually, my father's name was Yankelevich.
Yes.
And he was born in Poland.
Yes.
And he changed it to Yanks, Y-A-N-K-S, when
okay.
he came to this country.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was 10 years old, playing on a program called The Magic Key, which... Milton Cross was the announcer for...
Milton Cross, yes.
And then a man who became sort of my musical papa was Samuel Schwarzenegger.
Oh, yes.
Who was the director of NBC Music and married to Heifetz's sister. Anyway, they both got together. So that's a terrible name for pianist Byron Yanks. So it's changed to Janis. Since at 10, and it's remained that.
Yes, J-A-N-I-S.
J-A-N-I-S. Actually, the first change to J-A-N-N-E-S, and then everybody called me Janis, so they said, make it J-A-N-I-S, and that's when I got my name. Anyway, so he said to my mother, "You know, that's the teaching I had in Russia. Do you want to baby him about playing wrong notes?" And so
terrible.
My mother said, "Well, I guess it's good. If it happened in Leningrad, it was good enough. It's okay for Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania," which is where I was born.
Okay.
And then he taught me for a few years, and he said to my mother, "Eventually, I have nothing left. I don't have anything left to teach him." And that startled me, because I thought, my goodness, I mean, that's all there is to learn?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, he called up Joseph Levine in New York, whom he did not know.
Yes.
But it was kind of Russian to Russian.
Yes.
Know? And it worked, because Levine said, "Well, bring him to New York. We'd like to hear him play."
How old were you at that time?
I was 8 years old.
Okay.
And we went to New York. I played for both him and Rosina. And they said afterwards that they would like to work with me. And, of course, I was thrilled to death. But it meant that my mother had to move to New York.
Mm-hmm.
So my father stayed in Pittsburgh, my mother and I. And I and my sister moved to New York when I was 8. And we lived that way for some 5 years. And it was very difficult, because I was, you know, my mother, I think, missed my father a great deal. And I missed my father mm-hmm. a great deal. But that was a sacrifice that she wanted to make. And I And, you know, and I was important to her, I guess, for whatever reason.
How was it being a child prodigy in terms of, were you aware that you were unusual, or did you, I mean, in terms of the normality of going to school and so on and so forth?
Yes, well, I realized that there was something different about being a child prodigy, so to speak. But I also had a very, very normal school life, because fortunately, my mother was not a stage mother,
mm-hmm.
and she went along with the advice that was given to her by people who knew much more about it than she did. And I felt I went normally to school 4 hours a day. I went to school in New York, where I had a scholarship. Columbia Grammar was the name of the school.
Mm-hmm.
Very good private school. And then at 10, Billy Veens, I worked with them from really 8 to 10. I worked with him 1 week, with her another week. And I learned one of the most important lessons, I think, in my life, at that age, which was they would argue. Sometimes they'd be in the same room when I would be playing. And I would play a phrase, or and I heard them argue about this in Russian, which I didn't understand, but I understood that they had differing opinions about what I should do. And that taught me that even the great mm-hmm. artists differ in what how something should be played. And I knew there wasn't one way to do something. That was a very important lesson.
Yes.
Because later on, when I had to keep my identification studying with great pianists such as Horowitz, it was important. It helped me realize that when he would say this to me, and I'd say, well, that's not what I really feel. I'd say this to myself, but I know that it's all right to do something another way.
Well, didn't he tell you to find your own solution to the problem?
Yes, he did. I was the first person he worked with, and it was he. I must say that he was a very interesting, if I can say, teacher, from the point of view that he never overtaught. By that I mean he would say, just as you said, he would say, something is not right with that. I don't know what it is. You take it home and think about it and bring it back to me next time. So he would not tell me. He wanted me to find what I would find to make it sound better.
I think one of the great things about teaching is to teach your students how to work out the problems so that you
exactly.
And that is really the hallmark of a great teacher.
You're so right.
Yes.
I write occasionally for the Wall Street Journal, and I've written an article on teaching, the last one, which is not out yet. But it speaks about, I think, the credo for a teacher should be, let him allow the student to play his own way, even though it differs from yours, and don't dominate him with your own thoughts about interpretive things,
And then, of course, you do learn how to resolve problems that way.
Yes, you do, and on your own.
On your own, yeah.
And that's so important, and I mean, so many teachers simply tell everybody what to do,
I
just heard a most horrible story about someone teaching at a very important music school who put on a recording of somebody playing the same piece that the student was playing, said, that's the way to play that.
Well, I went to Juilliard. I studied with Marcel Grangeny. I'm a harpist.
I see.
And Mr. Grangeny did that. The way he taught. He taught us how to solve problems. And that's one of the great things you do learn. And because nobody's around there later on in life to lead you by the hand. So, but you also studied with Adele Marcus, didn't you? And I've spoken to several pianists who studied with her and just adored her.
Yes. Well, I studied with her when the Levine's traveling schedule got to be very busy. They had me study with her, who was kind of an associate teacher. She had worked with Levine and worked also with Schnabel, by the way.
Mm.
And so I studied with her and played for them once a month, more or less, for quite a while. And then eventually I stopped playing for her, for them once a month, and I just studied with Miss Marcus. And she went, when I was 13, she got a call from her husband who was in Dallas that he needed her for purposes of teaching, et cetera, et cetera. So she went down to Dallas. And the question for me was, what happens to me? My mother had to go back to Pittsburgh, and my father was not well, so I was left in the middle. But eventually, it was Jan Pierce, actually, who found a family in Dallas with whom I could live.
How did you have a connection with him?
Through Adele Marcus.
Uh-huh.
And at that point. And it was Schatzenhoff who said, you know, mm-hmm. let him go down there because she's a good teacher and he's doing so well. So I did. I followed her to Texas, and I spent two winters down there studying with her.
Well, I did read your book, and you did say in the book that it was your acquaintances that kind of saved you as a young person in terms of the various people that you met and that perhaps you stayed with even. This was in Texas, wasn't it, that you went?
Yes.
Yeah. That really kind of put you on the track in a sense of your life, not your musical life, but certainly your yes. day-to-day experiences.
Yes. Well, I went to a Princeton public school down there, and I didn't have to open a book. It was so easy to get straight A's. You know, it wasn't up to the standards of, at that time anyway, what the New York situation mm-hmm. was. But I learned a lot down in Texas. I learned how to drive. I also had my first affair down there.
Yes, that's another thing. You're rather a Lothario, aren't you? I mean, in your book, you have many, many different encounters with a lot of women.
Yes.
And you're very delighted to have them. And rather candid about some of them, I would say. I'm sure that they were enjoying you as well. So.
Well, I was, you know, sort of highly romantic fellow, and I still am.
Yes, you and Chopin, I think you're definitely the same.
Pardon me?
You and Chopin.
Chopin, yes. Me and Chopin. Well, you know, he was, you know, Chopin really was, he adored beautiful women, you know?
Yes.
He really did. And a lot of people with this homosexual feeling that a lot of people said, well, he was that and so on. I think that's totally wrong, because if you look at his life, he was always involved with women. And some of the stories we don't even know about, but there's a lot. You know, he was very mannish, Chopin, despite the fact that he was frail and mm-hmm. had a feminine sort of a, well, how can I say that? Some people thought he was feminine in mm-hmm. the sense that he didn't yell or whatever you want
was,
to say.
He was gentle and...
Gentle. He yes, was very gentle.
Yes, yeah.
Except when students played, he didn't like them, and he threw things around the room where music was concerned. But he was a very gentle and a very profound person.
You had an affinity, though, for his music. And, of course, in the book, I mean, you have all these amazing encounters. And yes. And then, of course, the discovery of those two waltzes, which made, I guess, national headlines.
Yeah, that was... Well, when I was very little, for some reason, you know, I can't compare music to Chopin, to Beethoven, to Schumann, or whatever. How can you compare greatness? It's not possible for me. They're very different. But in this case, he was the man. For some reason, I wanted to know a lot about him when I was very young. And I asked my mother to get all the books she could about Chopin, and I read all these things about him. And I felt, I can't tell you why or what, but I felt some sort of a kinship with him. My father was Polish, by the way. My mother was Russian, but of Polish descent. Perhaps it was my Polish blood. I don't mm-hmm. know. But something about him struck a chord.
A lot of chords, I guess.
A lot of chords in me. So that became a very strong influence in my thinking.
I think that even now they are talking about Chopin as a composer being very forward-looking. And before the, before this, the, I don't think you ever really heard that kind of discussion about Chopin, of course, technically, and his, you know, his writing for the piano and so on. But they are, they are beginning to discover that he really had, you know, this, his, it, stylistically, the etudes and the fantasies and, you know, everything was a new way of presenting music he was exploring.
Chopin's music came out of nowhere. I mean, there's nothing before it to, you know, show us that this came from something before. It didn't. And when he died, nothing happened afterwards. It was just placed here, kind of, for some reason. And I think nobody wrote for the piano better than he, and nobody, and he only could write for the piano, as you know. He didn't understand orchestral writing at all. You can see that from his concertos. And he was interested in singers mostly, and he would always tell his students, "Go hear great singing, and you will know how to phrase."
For the melodic line, I guess.
Yes. And but when this waltz thing, you know, as you say, I was in France, and I had a young Count de la Panouse who had a chateau. It was 1600, family dated back to 1100, and it was, he loved Chopin. He came to my concerts in Paris, and he invited me and my wife out to his, out to the chateau for lunch. So we accepted him with great pleasure. And it was there that I said, and in the archive room, he took us to his archive room, and things were scattered over that floor in the shelves. And nothing was cataloged. It was all over the place at that point. And, you know, you could pick up letters from the Crusades. And from one king to another. Why should we behead so-and-so? Think about it before we do that. And one very interesting paper that said, money to feed the wolves in Paris. It's, I mean, incredible things.
Fascinating.
So anyway, and then there was this trunk marked old clothes, which Maria wanted to look at, and he said, please. So we opened his trunk, and there were these beautiful clothes of his grandmother, Clémence de la Panouse, who was a very beautiful young lady. And somewhere underneath this, in the middle of these things, I saw something that looked like a manuscript, looked like music, and I just gingerly pulled it out, and my goodness, there were two pieces of music tied together with a blue ribbon. And what were they? Two Chopin waltzes.
Unbelievable.
It was unbelievable because they were both known waltzes, the Valse Brillante, which is famous, which the English
call... Yes, of course, the great Valse Brillante.
Yes, and the English call it the Invitation to the Dance. And
everybody knows that one.
And then this, a little one, which was published posthumously, and there was no known manuscript of that waltz at that time. So this became the only manuscript. Chopin didn't want to publish it, but his friend Fontana decided he wanted to publish it, and he did. And this must have been the where he published it from. Anyway, it made a big noise in the music world, because finding Chopin manuscripts are very rare, of course. And there was a front page story by Harold Schoenberg, New York Times, and it was on the news, Walter Cronkite, etc. And I'm telling you that for a reason, because 6 years later I was at Yale and giving a master class, and just before leaving I pointed up to something on one of the shelves, and I said, what's that? And there were about four or five professors in the room with me, and they said, oh, let me see. So he got on the ladder, he went up there, and he said, oh, it's Marc Chopin. So I said, oh, Marl, can I see it, please? So I was sitting down, and I opened this folder, and I must have turned every color in the rainbow, because one of them said to me, what's the matter? You don't look well. I said, no, this is not possible. I said, what's not possible? I said, never mind, take me to the train. I couldn't even speak about it. But what was there were the same two waltzes in different versions again.
My goodness. Original manuscripts?
Original manuscripts, and I knew they were in his hand because he had a unique way of writing the bass clef. Nobody wrote it in the fashion in which he wrote it. So it was pretty clear to me that it was in his hand. And I said, well, what happened? I mean, you had these waltzes and nothing was said. Well, we didn't catalog them, and somehow I guess it fell through the cracks.
My goodness.
Can you imagine?
No.
So they never said a word. That we've got two other ones. They were written a year earlier, 1832. The ones I found at, in the Chateau in France, excuse me, were 1833, and they were published in 1835.
My goodness.
Published, and Chopin, he was rather enamored of this young lady who lived on the... Clémence de la Panouse, Chopin, the grandmother of my friend Count de la Panouse. And so he brought her these two waltzes as a present one day. Where a man might bring flowers today, right?
Mm-hmm.
He brought the waltzes. I'd say that's pretty fair. Pretty good alternate.
Well, possibly at that time, though, it wasn't as valuable, but it certainly was valuable to him, I guess,
no,
to give
course.
To her.
No, yes. No, it wasn't because, well, when he first came to Paris, he was really not known at all. When he was 21, he left Warsaw, and he wasn't known, but he ran into one of the Rothschilds in the street, and they said, he ran into Esther Hazy, Radzivill,
who's
Polish family.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, the Polish family. And he said, come with me, I'm going to the Rothschilds, have a tea with us or something. So he did go, and he asked him to play, which he did, and Rothschild said to him, would you teach our daughters? I'd love it. So that's how it started.
That's how it started.
He could make a little money, because he almost came to this country. His friend was over here and said, why don't you come to America? Forget Europe. It's, you know, it's not good for you there in Paris. And he would have come. And one wonders what would have happened, you know. But he didn't, because he started to teach. And that's how he made money his entire life.
Now, did you always have an affinity for his music as an artist? Or was this all part of your discovery and...
No, I always did, because the man and the music interested me. So together, it was, it made me feel something very special.
You know, there's so much to talk about with you, but one of the most unbelievable things that I read in your book was you had a mask of Chopin.
Yes.
One of three, I think you said, that are
that's,
were ever
that's
made.
Correct. Death mask,
was it a
right?
death mask? Is
death
that
mask, yes.
Can you tell that story? It is unbelievable, and of course brings in this whole other aspect of your life and the influence of whatever you want to call it in your life.
Yes. Well, okay, I will tell you that story. I have a very good friend named Uri Geller.
Yes.
Who was a Israeli.
Yes, yeah, I remember he was
remember him?
He, very,
he,
very popular.
Yes, he was. He's now living in England. He's still very popular
still doing
over
his,
there. And he's, whatever, he's a very different person from me because we're very close friends because he's a bit of a showman and all those things, which made a lot of people think he wasn't real. But he is. These bending of
the spoons and
with the mind was... totally mind over matter, and that really is only the tip of the iceberg. And much as the stories which I tell in this book, in a way, are the tip of the iceberg, because there's so much that's happened to me, and some to my wife, Maria, as well, in this paranormal, for me, a terrible word. I despise that word, because it gives the wrong impression. I think... what I'd like to call it was the unknown normal. It's everything. And let me quote Edgar Mitchell, who was the astronaut on Apollo 13, who landed on the moon. And he said it so well. He said, there is nothing in this world that isn't normal. Everything is normal. It is our lack of understanding
yes.
that makes it, quote, abnormal, so to speak, but mm-hmm. it's totally normal. And that is so true. Everything that happens.
But it's
normal.
A very hard concept to.
It probably is.
Yes.
Because, but you know, people forget, I don't understand, because all progress makes something that was impossible before possible. Isn't that true?
Yes, and of course it's knowledge as well. I mean, you know,
right.
you know, knowledge is power, as they say, and of course as you learn, and yeah. scientifically as you learn, worlds open up. But
yes,
with
but
you, your whole life has been so influenced. You, from what I could tell, you can't separate this from your life. It's so much of it is integrated. And as one who believes in ESP, I can see that there are probably instances where you perhaps even foresaw some of the things that had happened to you. But
yes.
but your career and your dreadful, you know, disability of this horrible arthritis and the
yes.
and the accident to your pinky and surmounting all these obstacles and performing
right.
not only just performing but outstanding, great, one of the great artists, I say, of the 20th century, and exquisitely, and fighting all of this and continuing
yeah.
to live mm-hmm. and to produce and then to give to others, because you're very much involved in this arthritis foundation
yes.
as well.
Yes.
There's got to be some kind of power that may be surrounding you or driving you or protecting you.
Yes, you know, finally, I think everything is kind of energy.
Mm-hmm.
All these things have some energy component which nobody quite understands. But it's also, you know, what the word that I think is so important besides having talent is passion.
Yes.
If you don't have passion for something and you cannot ever succeed with having mind over matter, so to speak. Because when I met Ulrich and he showed me that he bent a spoon, whatever, with his mind, I said, you don't need to show me anything else. I understand. And he was surprised. But I'd been doing that since I was 11. Mind that little finger. Oh, did I speak about that or not?
Well, it's in the book, but you...
Hadn't mentioned it. Well, when, you know, I had this accident with my little finger, putting it through a
glass
pane,
yeah.
a glass door. Sort of chasing my sister, and it totally, totally decimated the finger.
Well, it severed the nerve and the tendon.
And the tendon.
Because the tendon is the one that really is
yes.
the one for a pianist, certainly, in any case.
Yes. I lost the joint. One of the joints doesn't bend.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, and since 11, that finger has been totally numb.
How did you play? You played.
Totally
you played.
Numb.
Did you disregard and refinger, or did you?
I did. Well, you use a good word, disregard. I sort of said to myself. Everybody said, "That's it. He's finished."
Mm.
And at that point, everybody said he's finished. Da, 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 and I just didn't accept that. And. Somehow I just said, I just went on.
But you were finished, in quotes, at 10, if that were the case.
Yeah.
So you
already
had achieved at that point where they were saying, okay, he can't do it anymore.
Yes, I was playing on the radio, and mm-hmm. I was playing little concerts and so forth around. But, yes, exactly. So he was finished, but I found ways also to use my eye peripherally is what I mm-hmm. wanted to say, in a peripheral way, that I could see the end of my hand, I could see that little fifth finger in my left hand, and the eye plus doing it over and over and over, finding a way, you know, getting into the habit, is what made me be able to play, really, and I continued.
But did you couldn't use that finger, is that right?
Well, I used the finger, but I didn't know where it was going to go.
Okay, but because you didn't feel anything,
feel it.
But it was there.
It was like really playing with nine fingers
okay.
in a sense.
But you actually did have, if you have five note scale or something. I mean, you used your pinky. Yeah.
Sure, I did. I used it, and but as I say, it was. I didn't have any idea. I didn't feel the note at all. So it took a lot of work on my part to manage to do that. And that stayed with me all my life. Some of the arthritis doctors have said to me, you know, arthritis that you have is bad enough. But for us, the most incredible thing is that little finger.
Yes.
How you could play with that. And, you know, I did all the big virtuoso concertos.
I know you did the, I mean, in Russia, what was it, the Rocky 3 and 2 and the Liszt 1 and 2. And you were teasing the audience, too, because I read that you would play both of the Liszt concertos in tandem. So
that's right.
You were showing off there, weren't you, a little bit?
Well, I don't know. You know, I did my first three concerto evening in Russia. With the, I think it was Vasily Prokofiev's third, Schumann,
unbelievable.
And Rachmaninoff first. And I remember the conductor was Kondrashin, Kirill Kondrashin, was wonderful.
Yes, of course.
Wonderful conductor, and accompanist.
You followed
also.
Van the Cliburn there, didn't you? I mean, you were after Van.
Yes, but you see, if I may tell you the story about our ambassador, after I played my first recital in Moscow, he said to me, thank God you've come, because the Russians are saying all America can produce are cars.
Oh.
They have no culture. And the only pianists they have, we had to discover.
Mm.
And that was Mr. Cliburn in a competition.
Oh.
So that was what I was up against. Besides, I was up against this U-2 spy plane that they shot down just about 4 months before I came. And when I walked out on the stage in Moscow, the audience was shouting, U-2, U-2, U-2.
Oh, my.
It was very hostile.
So, and, but you had such, I don't know if it's courage or if it's, as we say, chutzpah. I don't know what it was, but you just went for it. I mean, you just knew what you were doing. You had faith in what you believed and the power, and you continued on and, of course, had an amazing, amazing career as an artist.
Well, I believe from what I have seen and done and seen others, what about the man who bicycled across this country with one foot, one leg.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's extraordinary what people can do. And I have determined that almost anything is possible.
And what gives you that courage?
Pardon?
What gives you that courage? The belief that anything is possible?
What gave me that courage?
Yeah.
Well, because I kept overcoming things. With my hands, my wrists, and I saw that. At first, I thought I'm never going to be able to play again, and I did it, contrary to all opinions.
So you were going to prove this, Ken Vito.
I was out, I suppose, to prove. In some way, I was out to prove it. Yes. In some way, I was out to prove it. But in another way, it was. I don't know. It felt so natural for me not to give in to anything. Just come on. There's always a way to do this. When somebody. I've had 5 surgeries on my hands, and five of them by a great surgeon, and one of them was by a surgeon who shortened my thumb in the operation. And that, I thought, I would never get it. It's about a third of an inch shorter than the other one.
My goodness.
Maybe a fourth of an inch, all right. A fourth of an inch. Anyway, I thought, this I will never get over. And I went into my room and it was a total depression.
Well, in other words, this was a terrible setback once again, and you
terrible
and
setback.
You overcame.
I thought that was it. I would never get over this. Mm-hmm. And then it was interesting that my wife is Gary Cooper's daughter.
Yes.
And she did some television documentaries on him, and she came to me and said, you know, Byron, I want you to write the theme to this documentary on my father. So I said, oh, Maria, I can't even move.
This is when you started to write, to compose.
Yes, I actually was writing, you know, songs. A lot of my life I was wanting to write melodies, themes, which, by the way, are the hardest thing in the world to write.
Mm.
But But I really enjoyed writing, and I never did anything with these songs because I was touring 9 months of the year, you know. I had no way of doing anything with them. Sort of, your program is crossover, right?
Yes. Well, it's really crossing over the barriers of the kind of music, not necessarily.
I understand.
In other words, music all comes from the same place. We know that.
It does indeed.
Yes.
Anyway, I was doing another kind of music, fairly popular music, in a sense. And by the way, I love jazz. I think jazz is
brilliant.
Actually,
yeah.
Great, because it's improvised.
Mm-hmm.
And it's these really great jazz pianists and great jazz musicians, really. I listen to them whenever.
Have you ever tried it on your own?
Yeah, I am not
a
good jazz pianist.
Yeah.
And I cannot do it, I must say. But I can't. It's too difficult. But what I do, and which I think is so important and should bring classical music, which is having a bad time, back to the
improvisation.
Yes, exactly. Which was what they used to do in the 19th century. They'd call up, somebody in the audience would call up A, B, D,
right.
G, and the pianist, one of them was Chopin,
yes.
would improvise on those four notes,
I'm convinced that the opening of the Emperor Concerto was an improvisation.
Yes. Well, it sounds like it.
Yeah, it sounds like. I think Beethoven said, well, I'm going to use this chord, and I'm going to diddle around on it for a while.
Well,
it just sounds that way.
We have written statements from people that Beethoven's improvising, believe it or not,
really?
Was even greater than what he wrote. So he improvised a lot.
And Bach did too, I think.
Sure. Yes, and I think, you know, in a abstract sense, a great performance sounds like it's improvised.
Mm.
It's spontaneous.
Yes.
It's done at the moment. Too many people try to play, I think, as they practice. You can't. First of all, the sound is different in the auditorium, the piano is different, everything's different. And if you maintain that idea, I've got to play the way I play, I think you're not going to have a very good performance.
Well, that's the spontaneity that you're talking about,
exactly.
I think. Now,
yeah.
You have a whole... Are you going to be releasing all of your discs? Is this a... I know you've done the book, and there is a documentary that's being done.
Right.
But...
It's out now. Yes, the documentary is being shown.
That's actually going to be shown, I think, here in Philadelphia. And,
I think it's on January 2nd, I think.
Yes.
In Philadelphia. Yes, it's done by Peter Rosen. And it's really dedicated. I don't go into the paranormal in this documentary, but it's dedicated to people who are overcoming adversity. And it's gone through my life in a musical way, of course, and how I fought all these things.
Now, you are a spokesperson for the Arthritis Foundation.
That's right.
As well,
yes,
aren't
I am.
You?
Yeah, for 25 years I have been. And I'm going to be very active now again.
Have you witnessed any miracles amongst the people that you've met that have arthritis?
Any miracles?
Yes, like yours.
Well, you know, it's really not a miracle. It's using this mental ability, which we all have. Some of us have stronger minds than others. To make something occur that you can, you know, it's interesting. People who are very ill and are about to die, and their son or daughter, let's say, is getting married 6 months from that point later. Invariably, these people will live that 6 months and die right after the ceremony, shortly after.
That's
now,
true.
That's mind, isn't it?
Mind over the reality, I guess.
Absolutely. And that's it's always the case. There was a young man named Roger Bannister who broke the four-minute mile about 60 years ago in first person to break running the four-minute mile. He did it under 4 minutes.
Mm.
Nobody had done it before. When he did it, everybody started breaking the four-minute mile because they knew it was possible.
Well, then anything is possible? Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. And that was one of the reasons, really, for my writing the book, was to tell people that, look, you can do everything. Anything is possible, almost. And by giving them all the stories that I've told them, and also scientific backup to this. I mean, Einstein said, it's fun to do the impossible. That's already, they're admitting that there is an impossible, right?
Well, we set the bar always, don't we?
Yes, we do. Much too low.
Yes, yes.
Much too low. And he said also, we understand about 2% of how the universe functions.
Well, I think, wasn't there some scientific finding that we only use a very, one-tenth of what our mental
yes.
powers are?
Oh, yes, about 8% of the brain or something.
Something like that.
But think of people don't bother to think about it, about what that means. I mean, the simple thing, 100 years ago, 100 years ago or 150 years ago, I mean, flying was thought totally impossible. Mm. Nobody, who would say you could fly in an airplane? Nobody. Say, come on, that's impossible. And then somebody does it, and it became possible. I think we take these extraordinary successes and miracles that we have around us all the time, we forget about them very quickly.
Well, I think survival is a miracle, too, in many cases. There are people that live and countries that survive and all kinds of horrible things.
Absolutely.
And come back to life, maybe. And yeah. I think that we have to give ourselves the margin. We can do a lot more than, and people like you are inspiring, certainly. And,
well, I think.
But you're very unusual. I have to say that, Mr. Dennis, I really do think you are an unusual, special talent on top of everything else, but you do have this tremendous will to excel and also to overcome adversity. And I think that is, we need more people like that as, examples.
Yes, I think one story I remember, which was so lovely. I played in, I think it was Worcester, Massachusetts, and parents came back with their daughter and said, oh, she was a dancer, but arthritis set in and she can't dance anymore. Well, 6 months later, I heard from the Arthritis Foundation, they called up them and said to give me a message, which was that after she heard me do play and all the story and whatever, she asked if she could live in her own apartment, and which they said, all right. And she started dancing again.
Amazing.
And she said, the thing was this, if he can do it, I can do it.
And then she probably loved it so much, just like you said, had such a passion for dancing. That also helped.
She did. She couldn't have done another one, you know. You have to really have a passion. You have to have your foot down on the accelerator all the way. I'm not going to accept anything. Now, at a certain point, there is a point where it may become an obsession and you keep trying and nothing happens. You have to let go at that point. But that point comes much later than most people think it should.
So now what do we have to look forward to you doing after this, and what's next?
I think you spoke about these recordings.
Yes, the releasing of the old
movies. I went through some live performances from 1975 to 1995 that I did all with bad arthritis, and came up with a recording which I think will be released. I know will be released next year.
What is that?
Pardon?
Which one is that?
This recording of mine with Haydn, Sonata, Chopin. It's a
mixed bag.
It's a mixed bag, yes, of things that I chose, from mazurkas, Chopin, some Liszt, I think, and there are three songs on it that I wrote myself.
And those are that discovery of your ability to write pop tunes is another thing as well that probably you never really explored until you had to. What about playing anything anymore other than just...
Well, I tell you, the arthritis has my extension in between my thumb and my fifth finger has lessened, it keeps getting smaller.
Of course. Well, that and happens anyway, I think, as you get older.
Perhaps. So. Yeah, maybe. But anyway, I can just reach an octave with my right hand, and with my left hand, I cannot reach one. That has severely impeded my technical playing. But what I do, I still play certain repertoire. There's repertoire I can handle, and I don't give recitals anymore as such. But there are various kinds of evenings and talks that I do. I do one talk on, let's say, Chopin, Words and Music, and I go through his life and play sort of things that he wrote at a certain time, et cetera, et cetera. And I try to make them not academic sounding.
Yes.
And interesting. I think that's another way, and there are pianists who are doing that today, who are talking about the composer, the piece, and so, which makes it so much more interesting.
Of course, it's a different insight into the whole creative process.
Yes.
Well, as I said, I can talk to you forever, but
we have to stop.
Thank you so very much, and I hope one day I'll have the pleasure of meeting you. I hope you come to Philadelphia at some point.
Well, thank you very much.
What a pleasure. Thank you.
Enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.